Hello, everybody. This is Robert the Tech Doctor. Along with me, as always, is Allison Hartley. How you doing, Miss Allison?
I'm doing wonderful. And have we not established that I am now the tech nurse? That was what Shane Jackson said on Twitter. Well,
that's what Shane Jackson is calling you, although I personally think you are, without question, a tech doctor, your own self.
Oh, well, thank you.
But at any rate, we are going to do the first podcast that we have ever done while both running the Mavericks operating system. And so we're hoping that Mavericks will serve us well.
Hope so.
Nothing like being on the bleeding edge, huh?
I should know.
Yeah. All right. But today is going to be a podcast that I have been looking forward to for a few weeks now. Our very special guest has written a book about her life. It's a memoir. And we'll be talking about this book. And I got about halfway through the book and realized that it would be so wonderful to have this woman come on the podcast so that we can talk about this book and really more importantly about her. She's involved with all kinds of different things, including various aspects of technology. So it's with great pleasure that we welcome Sue Martin to the podcast. And Sue, thank you so much for taking us some time to be with us today.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for the invitation. My pleasure.
Well, you're welcome. It's very nice to have you here. And I was actually found out about your book through the National Braille Press publication called the Syndicated Columnist Weekly. They published a chapter of your book, and I read that, and I encourage everyone to take a serious look at this Braille Press publication. It's really a great way to keep up with the news and what's going on in the world. But as is typical, when something exciting is happening and something worth reading is available, they let us know about it. And your book was no exception. So you've done something that more people are doing these days, but something that a lot of us talk about and don't quite ever get around to, and that's writing a book and publishing it. And can you just maybe start out by telling us a little bit about that process, how you got to that point, and why you decided to do it, and that kind of thing, if you don't mind?
I, several years ago, wrote about my own process of blind rehabilitation, and I put it aside because at that point, I wasn't quite ready to talk about how I became blind. And the time for that came almost 2 years ago when I heard of the death by suicide of a woman that I did not know. She lived in England, and I had been quietly talking to some people about the fact that my blindness is the result of a suicide attempt with a gun. And people who knew my story, who were friends of this woman, started coming to me and asking questions. What if they had reached out? Could they have prevented this woman from taking her life? And it was at that point that I decided it was time to tell the rest of the story.
It was because you began to realize the importance of, in a sense, talking about what happened and trying to help people really understand and maybe debunk some of the myths and some of the stereotypes. And it's way better to talk about things than not. And it sounds like that was maybe part of the impetus for it.
Yeah, I think it was. When I wrote the story of my own rehab several years ago, I had several motivations for doing that. And one of the motivations was to portray what it's like to learn to live with blindness as accurately as possible. As I realized that it was time to write the entire story, one of my motivations is to destigmatize suicidal depression and get it out in the light of day, because every time I have told my story, somebody says to me, I attempted suicide, or I thought about attempting suicide, or I know someone who has attempted suicide. And that's what convinced me that this is my mission.
Yeah.
Because you can't, if you're depressed, you can't get help unless you're willing to talk about it. And as long as there is a stigma or shame associated with suicidal depression, people can't talk about it and they can't ask for help.
Right. Shame and vulnerability mm-hmm. are one of my real areas of interest and something that I work with every day as a psychologist. And of course, shame is really that great fear of disconnection. If they really knew mm-hmm. who I am, really, if they knew how inadequate I really am or how broken I really am, they wouldn't want anything to do with me. And unless you begin to talk about that and begin to somehow overpower that shame or turn the volume down on that shame so that you can hear the other part of you, which really needs and wants connection and a feeling of worthiness and love, as all human beings do, it's impossible to move beyond that depression. And maybe we're just a tiny bit ahead of ourselves here. It's probably become clear to the listeners now, but you begin in your book, early in the book, talking about the fact that you had become very depressed at that point in your life and eventually did attempt suicide with a gun, which resulted in blindness. I want people to read the book. I don't want to tell the whole story necessarily, but you are very upfront and very, very forthcoming about that process. And I think that's one of the places where the book has a real sense of power and honesty.
A lot of people say, oh, it must have been such a cathartic experience. And it kind of was, but the main emotions I had about writing about my depression is I wanted to get it right. I wanted to draw out the feelings of alienation, of feeling so alone that life ceases to have meaning. There's nothing to get out of bed for in the morning. And I think the honesty in that first chapter, I really do feel like I captured what it felt like. It's a good representation of how I felt.
I definitely agree. And you not only captured what it felt like and how it was just getting more and more impossible for you to feel like you could go on, but it was really quite a peeling of the onion, if you will, some of the multiple layers, when you eventually began to start to recover from having survived the suicide attempt, and you realized that you weren't able to see at that point, which just at least for a while, as I read it, furthered or continued the depression.
Just because I shot myself, that didn't mean that I was magically not depressed anymore.
Exactly.
yeah.
You detail quite a bit about what it was like to try to begin to rebuild your life after the suicide attempt. And I think that's just such an important piece because it sort of blends some of the mental health aspects with sort of the rehab aspects. And that's something that I haven't seen too many books attempt. I think it took some real forethought and honestly some real courage to pull those together.
The title of chapter 3 is Intensive Care. And at the end of that chapter, to me, is one of the most poignant scenes in the book, especially in the early parts of the book when the judge comes to see me in the hospital, because it was like the inner judge met the outer judge.
Mm-hmm.
and we cried. We wept together.
Yeah, and you really will have to read the book to fill in the details there on the judge. We're not going to do it all for you here, folks. Do you have reactions, Allison, to the early parts of the book or to what we're talking about here? What's it like for you?
I'm coming at this from the perspective of actually having read Sue's blog as she was publishing the initial chapters and kind of following the story from the beginning. And I actually purchased the audiobook as soon as it came out. And I feel that by listening to Sue actually narrating her own story, it was heart-wrenching and honest and beautiful, and just, I won't ever forget the first experience of hearing this book as long as I live. It was really that powerful for me.
Wow.
Yeah, it was, I mean, to go through the journey with you, hearing your voice take me through, it was amazing. And I'm just really excited to be able to talk with you today.
You bring up something that a lot of people ask me about writing and how my writing actually turned into a book, because I did start by publishing chapters to a blog. I had no idea about my skill as a writer, whether my story would be interesting to people. Based on reader feedback, I stopped publishing chapters to the blog after what was then chapter 17, because I realized that I was actually writing a book. The crucial point for me was when I published three stories about the farm in Mississippi. My father grew up on a farm in Nettleton, Mississippi, and when my grandparents died, my parents kept the farm as a working farm until my brother and I were both out of high school. And my best friend, Addie McGriff Walters, and I spent many, many happy times on that farm. So I wrote the stories about the farm and published them to my website and dedicated them to my friend Addie. And I called her up and said, Addie, I've written these three stories. I've dedicated them to you, and here's the URL. So Addie read the stories, and then, of course, she started reading the blog entries, and she said, you have got to publish these in a book. And I told her that I wanted to do that, but I didn't know how. She said, no problem. And she introduced me to my editor. My editor and I have approached this whole book publication thing the old-fashioned way. He did a period of due diligence during which he read everything that I had written. And at the end of his due diligence, he took my book on. Then we did structural editing. And the crucial thing about the structural editing were the turns. He called them the turns. And the turns in the book are the five parts of the book: remorse, rehabilitation, recovery, resolve, and reconciliation. And once we had the structural editing done, together we did line editing. And then he did the copy editing on his own. And he was so funny about the copy editing. He's like, do you want to know about like every paragraph or every punctuation mark that I change? And I said, Bobby, I haven't seen a book in 30 years. Do your thing. I was very fortunate to hook up with my editor. He's been in the industry his entire professional life, and he has done a really good job for me.
That is quite a process that you describe. It sounds like it's one thing to have the chapters on a blog and quite another to actually turn them into a book. But it sounds like that wasn't the end of it from what you were telling me earlier, in that once you have the printed book, then apparently you went through quite a process to produce your own audio version.
Yeah. You know, a memoir just has to be in the person's voice who writes it. And so first I asked somebody that I know on Twitter if she would read it because she has, you know, a kind of a slight Southern accent. And at first she agreed, and then she backed down. She said it was just too much. I decided to try to record the book myself. So starting in mid-January of last year, I began recording the chapters. I divided the manuscript up into one phrase per line, and using a Plextalk pocket and binaural microphones, I just started reading it into the recorder. The problem is that it was capturing everything, my breathing, you know, if a door slammed somewhere, if I got tongue-tied. And it was just going to be too much work to get a clean recording. So then I hit upon the way that I finally did manage to record the book. Oh, I should say that I don't read Braille fluently enough to have read it from a Braille copy. The way that I finally did it was using the Plextalk pocket. I started the Plextalk recording and paused it. And then using a screen reader on a computer, I would listen to the phrase on each line, sort of get it in my head, unpause the recorder, speak the phrase, pause the recorder, hit down arrow on the computer, and on.
Okay, so how long did it take you to record this book this way?
Well, I had already recorded 40 chapters when I had to start over again.
Yeah.
But when I started it over, it actually only took me about a month to get it fully recorded. And then the trick was to edit out all the clicks that had been captured.
When you press the pause button.
Right, right. Yeah, and I did all of the audio production, and this baby is all mine.
Wow, it sure sounds like it.
Yeah, yeah.
But Sue, you know, one of the things that really came across so strongly to me when I read the book, and I, unfortunately, I didn't have Allison's experience. I didn't read the audio version. I read the Kindle version, which is another place that the book is available, and we'll talk about that. But mm-hmm. It sounds like in some ways I really missed out on something by not reading the audio. So people might want to, you know, think about which version you want to read. But the thing I was going to say is throughout the book, there's this real spirit that you have of determination when you decide to do something. There's not a whole lot that's going to get in your way of doing it. And this book, reading this book line by line, almost, you know, in a very, sounds like a very arduous, tedious process, is just one example of that. When you decide to do something, you figure out a way to do it. And there's really something very compelling about that. And do you have any comment on that? I mean, is that just because that's how you are and how you've always been? Or is that, have you developed that kind of tenacity? Or what would you say about that?
It's always been a part of who I am. I changed careers at the age of 51. Crazy.
Did you get the sports car also?
No. Although, actually, I did once win an autocross as a blind driver.
Okay.
That's another story. Anyway, after my own process of rehab, I decided to go into rehab as a professional. I went to Western Michigan University and earned my master's in rehab teaching, as it was called then, vision rehab therapy, as it's called now. And I worked in the field of rehab for about 22 years. Then in 2006, no, seven it was, I changed careers. I had spent the last 5 years of my rehab career as the subject matter expert for a computer access training section of a Veterans Affairs Blind Rehab Center. And the job that I took after that is still with the Department of Veterans Affairs, but now I work in the Office of Information as a Section 508 management analyst. And Section 508, for those who are not familiar with it, is a it's an amendment to the Rehabilitation Act that says that information communications technology used by a federal government agency will be accessible to people who have disabilities. I spent the first year in my new job scratching my head saying, why did you do this? I've been in that job now for 6 years, and I think what I've learned, and I believe this with my whole heart, that with the correct attitude, determination, and education, and the education is key, I can do anything that I want to do, and I think anybody can. You have to have that can-do attitude, you have to be determined, and you have to avail yourself of educational opportunities that are out there and available. A lot of education is free. For example, the manuals that the various screen readers and screen magnifiers publish. I've paid for a lot of training, and it's been worth every bit of it. Where I sit now, it's amazing. Having arrived at a place where I have so much confidence in my work and my ability as a writer, my ability to climb mountains.
You really transformed yourself. You started from a place of being very depressed, being very hopeless, feeling very inadequate, and have in 30 some years gotten to where you are now. And I think that's perhaps one of the most interesting parts of your story, if you look at it from a global perspective, is this this transformation that you have done, obviously through a lot of hard work and patience and a willingness to persist, but also some switch got flipped somewhere inside you, and you went from hopeless to believing in yourself. That's really at the bottom of the story, I think.
That switch got flipped at some point during my own process of rehabilitation. Somehow, the challenge, the necessity to learn how to do almost everything in a new way.
Yep.
Is what pulled me out of the depression.
You go through a lot of things in the book where you learned to cook, you learned Braille, you eventually got involved with Seeing Eye Dogs, which was really fun for me to read about because you and I have had some of the same instructors over the years.
Have we really?
Yeah. But you know, it's just that process, it seems like somehow as you got more and more excited, began to feel some passion for learning these new things, you started, in some sense, wanting to live again, getting your life back again.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I think so many people can benefit from hearing that story and traveling along with you in this book through those emotions, because the things that you describe and the things that you went through are not by any stretch of the imagination, other than the fact that you have your own subjective view of them, they're not unique to you. They're part of the human struggle, part of the human experience.
Yeah. And I did not write this book in a vacuum. I mean, you know, I had my editor, but I also had friends with whom I shared the book as I went along, and I received tremendous input from friends that helped me make this book the thing that it is today. And one of the things that I kept thinking about was, okay, I've gotten you through the suicidal depression, pulling the trigger, and waking up alive, and now I hope that you'll trust me to take you by the hand and lead you safely through the other adversity that's in the book, because there is more adversity, you know, without a doubt. It wasn't just a one time depression and then life was rosy.
Doesn't quite work that way.
No,
not usually.
There's always more mountain to climb, as you say, more layers of the onion to peel. Mm-hmm. And you do continue that same level of honesty and vulnerability and a willingness to say, this is really how it felt. This is really what happened throughout the book. And so it starts out with a very riveting depression, suicide issue, but the process just continues to unfold. And, you know, that's what actually happens when I work with someone in psychotherapy, is that process unfolds. And you've really given, in some ways, people a glimpse into how one's life does that by a willingness to share what you went through. And so that's what makes this book so valuable, I think.
Yeah, thanks. I think you're absolutely right. I kind of was away from the book for a little while before I went back to edit the recordings. When I went back to it to edit the recordings, I think there are three places in the book where I'm amazed that I was able to be that honest. It's not that I felt vulnerable. I think that honesty at that level, when you know you're going to put this thing out there in front of the world, the level of honesty where, even though I wrote those words, when I went back to edit the recording, it's like, wow, I really wrote that.
There's something in that process that's a little bit bigger than you are. And I guess I'm talking about the, in a sense, the spiritual part of it. You had to dig deep to write that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you're able to do that, I think, you know, what it really does is it reaches people on a level that we all want to be reached at, but then that most of us are afraid to go to for one reason or another. We in our society teaches us, mm-hmm, not to go there, and we sort of have to unlearn some of that junk and learn to go there. But that's one thing that you've done here.
Well, the comments, the reviews, for example, in the Kindle store, and just from emails that I've received, you know, from people who have read the book, almost every time in the reviews, people will say something like, I felt like I was walking beside you throughout the book. And it is a level of intimacy that it's just unlike anything I've ever experienced before. And it's wonderful. I mean, I have no regrets at all about the level of intimacy and just how people seem to connect with me as they go through the book.
I'm glad that people are taking the time to send you an email and let you know that.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, one of the things that's another recurring theme in reviews and in comments is what a star my husband Jim is.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
And, you know, people say, oh, it's a love story.
Well, you know, you kind of know that Jim has some real special qualities when you decide to get your nerve up and tell him about your suicide attempt, and his reaction is, okay.
Yeah, right. And I got to tell you, one of the comments that somebody who read the book made, you know, when you write a book, you expect people to ask for your autograph. Well, my friend said, can I have Jim's autograph? Yeah.
Well, and that's another place where it's really nice to see you talk so openly, honestly about your relationship and how it has grown over the years. And, you know, it's like all relationships, it hasn't all just been a piece of cake either. So, I mean, it's really nice to see that as well. I think it gives us all hope, you know, that we can learn to work together and maintain relationships. I've been in my relationship, we'll have been married, you know, 30 years next summer. And so it's cool when you can do that. And Allison's just finished year one, so she's
year
got
one. Yep.
She got a few more to go, but you do it 1 year at a time.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do it 1 hour at a time.
You're right.
Well, the book is available both as an audio version and on the Kindle store. Can you tell the Tech Doctor listeners how one could best go about getting a copy of the book?
It's available all over the place. The electronic distribution is being handled by Bookmasters in Ohio, and they have placed it in the Kindle store and the iTunes store. It's also available as a PDF, although I don't think anybody's really running out to get PDFs. So if you go to the Kindle store or the iTunes store and just type in a search field "Out of the Whirlpool," it'll come up. It's available in print and audio from my own website, outofthewhirlpool.com.
And I think we actually failed to mention that. That is the title of the book, Out of the Whirlpool.
Oh, yeah. By the way.
Yeah.
You can walk into any bookstore and order it. So you could walk into Barnes & Noble, for example, and ask them to order it, and they will. It is on the shelf at Sherman's Books in Bar Harbor, Maine.
Oh, wow.
Well, I spoke at a convention in Maine last month, and after the convention, Jem and I spent a few days at the Bar Harbor Inn, and we took a book to Sherman's right in Bar Harbor. And when the buyer learned that we lived in Alabama, she was like, "Well, I'll take two because you won't be able to come pick them up when you can't sell them." You
know, so. That's optimism for you.
Yeah, right. So I left two books with her. And then a little while later, I got an email and she asked me to come back to sign some other form. And as I was walking through the store, a friend saw me and followed me to the buyer's office and promptly bought the book. And so the buyer said, "Okay, that's half my stock. How many more do you have?" I did a book signing yesterday at the Golden Temple. It's a natural foods, health food store in Birmingham on Southside. And I left both print and audio books with them. The audio is on a thumb drive that has the name of the book engraved on it.
That's
so if
cool
you happen
thing.
To live in Alabama, you can get them there too.
And just for people who are probably interested in this, the audio is what, in MP3 format or?
Yes, it's 60 MP3 files, one for each chapter of the book.
Okay, and so if you actually go to your website, outofthewhirlpool.com, someone can purchase the audio and download it right there.
Correct. It's a download. There are three parts that you download.
I had the experience of reading the book on the Kindle, as I said, on the Kindle app on my iPhone, and it's a very nice way to read it. I'm sure it's not the same experience as the audio, and people may, you know, prefer the audio. But the nice thing about the Kindle edition is that it's very well done with the table of contents. Everything works as you would expect, and it's easy to go look something up again if you need to. I was real pleased with the way the Kindle edition came out.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's good. Good to know.
So I'm guessing that in some ways your life is changing or has changed a bit because of the book. At the very least, you're doing book signings and things like that and communicating with people that you probably wouldn't have otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I still, you know, have a full-time day job. And in fact, the imprint that we published under is called The Working Writer, a Discovery Group. My editor is keen on discovering new writers, people who have to work for a living, but whose passion is writing. And he has another book called The Paperboy, which is also by someone from Birmingham. I love the way that he's positioned this book. And one thing that I've discovered, just, you know, in terms of having my passion for writing, but having a day job too, is that when my tour of duty starts, I just have to, like, completely close the door on the book. The job is demanding. It requires a lot of concentration. I've gotten really good at compartmentalizing. Mm-hmm. I've had to, you know, otherwise I just don't think I could function.
Do you think that in some ways the having the two diverse things going on in your life, the writing and the job, they sort of help each other in the sense that it's nice to do something completely different at the end of the day or vice versa? I mean, it's very important for us to have these different outlets, I think.
Yeah, it is. I used to work past the end of my tour of duty, like if I was in the middle of something. My work life kind of bled over into my personal life. But nowadays, boy, 3:30 hits, I'm done.
Well, you have something else you want to get to.
Yeah, and a lot of times I sort of mark the transition at the beginning of my tour of duty or at the end by sitting in the hot tub. It's, you know, it's a great way to just be alone with my thoughts, to let go of the workday, come back inside, be relaxed, and be prepared to sit down and, you know, do the book thing. And I've continued writing. It's not like I wrote the book and I'm done. On my website, across the top are tabs, and I think the order is home, Sue sightings, serendipity, Sue buzz, and what people are saying. Sue sightings is my personal blog, and serendipity is the part of my website for more serious pieces of writing. One of the pieces on the Serendipity site, I love this piece. It's called An Education and Then Some. I spent a summer term at University College Oxford between my sophomore and junior years, and I didn't want to go. I wanted to go back to summer camp where I had gone as a camper and then as a counselor, and that's where all my friends from college were going, and that was sort of my summer life, you know, forever. So I got to Oxford, and the second week there, I had a cold, I was homesick, and a friend from Suwannee, that's where I went to college, by the way, knocked on my door. I had no idea that he was going to do this, and he had just graduated from the seminary at Suwannee, and he invited me to come to Coventry, where he was working for a year, and visit Coventry Cathedral and go kayaking with him. So the story is about that experience. And when I was writing it, the working title was The Paddle. You got to figure it out.
Yeah.
I've certainly continued to write, but in a slightly different way.
Just because I'm a little unclear, Sue, is this also the Out of the Whirlpool site, or is this a different site that this stuff is on?
It's outoftheworldpool.com.
Same site.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So people can go to outoftheworldpool.com and essentially get everything.
Yeah. My dog stories are there. I have 6 stories about my dogs. There's one on the Serendipity page that I really like called I Was Rehabilitated, The Role of Peak Experiences in the Rehabilitation Process. And that's a particularly good one, too.
Excellent. So I encourage everyone to go and visit this site, and I will, of course, put a link in the show notes to your website. And before we let you go, we promise not to take up too much more of your time, but I because this is a technology-oriented podcast, I know that you do and have done a lot of work with accessible technologies, and there's a fair amount of information about that in the book also. But what's your What's your take on technology these days? What do you think about where we're at with accessible technology?
Well, I think it's some really amazing things have happened over the past few years. I got my first iOS device, an iPhone, about 3 years ago. And I love my iPhone. I'm not as sort of crazy about it. I mean, I don't have 15 pages of of apps on it. I use it for specific purposes, and I use it well for those for those purposes. Yesterday during the book signing, Jim was with me, and he went to the other side of the Golden Temple to the cafe to have lunch. And the plan was that he was going to order something and, you know, eat sort of half of it, and then we'd switch. And then he would come sit at the table, and I would have my lunch. So he sent me an email that I somehow managed to ignore. So he calls me on FaceTime. The clerks in the store, I'm like looking at him going, my husband is FaceTiming his blind wife.
It works.
It did work. One thing that I learned, I cannot say enough about the level of support that JAWS for Windows has for Microsoft Word 2010. That's the program that I used to write the book. And, you know, for years, I knew that things like track changes and comments existed and that some people used them, but how they used them was a mystery. And the first thing my editor did when I hired him was to I had each chapter in its own file. So he took all the chapters and put them in one great big document and turned on track changes.
Sounds like a nightmare to me.
Oh, no. I read the documentation that JAWS for Windows has about how to use track changes and comments, and I was able to do it. And I was able to, swap back and forth between print layout and outline layout, which is also something that my editor wanted me to do. And it certainly is carried over into my work. You know, I used to sort of see track changes and go, wah!
Yeah.
So the level of support, within JAWS, Freedom Scientific has just done a great job with that. I'm not a Mac person, although I might be someday.
We might win you over to the bright side one of these days.
It's worth checking out. They've come a long way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's really great to hear that about JAWS and that level of accessibility, because for people who need that, if it wasn't there and you had a job that required it, people would be in a world of hurt.
Yeah.
Exactly. I also use it every day at work. So.
Yeah. I've been beta testing various assistive technology packages for years, but I sort of had to beg for clemency in the latest round. I did no JAWS 15 beta testing and no JSA, whatever version we're up to, beta testing. I just didn't have time.
Well, I think we've all discovered sometimes the hard way that you just cannot do it all.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
There just is not enough time to do. I get up in the morning with things on my list I really want to do, and I do as many of them as I can, and for whatever reason, 12 hours later, the day still comes to an end. So
right.
It's just how it's going to be, and I've had to sort of try to come to terms with that somehow.
Yeah.
Well, so it's been delightful to have you on the podcast. I think we've done what I had hoped we would do, is really try to give a flavor for the importance and the value of this book, and I thank you for, number one, writing it, and for, number two, taking the time to talk to us about it. And I'm hoping that people will really decide after hearing this they want to get a copy of it, and who knows, maybe they might even give one to somebody for Christmas. So,
well, yeah, there's just one thing I wanted to add
before
we close. You know, you hear that a book is about suicidal depression and new blindness, and you think, oh, how depressing is that?
Mm-hmm.
But it is not a depressing book. There is so much joy in this book. I had so much fun, especially writing the chapters about hiking and cross-country skiing. Far from being a depressing read, the book is a triumph. It truly is a triumph.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think the parts of the book that do talk about suicide and depression and other mental health concerns are necessary to really tell the Sue Martin story in the way that it happened. And they need to be there. They're important parts, but they're not by all means all that's right. There.
Exactly, yeah.
So I hope people will get the book and enjoy it as much as I did, and it sounds like as much as you did, Allison.
I did. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sue.
Thank you.
I wanted to just come back and talk a little bit about our experiences with Maverick so far, just to give people some ideas, because I know a lot of people are trying to make the decision whether to upgrade or not. And you and I have both done so. And
I did so on the first day.
Oh, yes, you did, didn't you?
I did, part of my constant need to be on the bleeding edge.
And how has it been for you so far?
You know, it hasn't been a bad experience. I did have some problems with Gmail, which were widely talked about on Twitter and on the various tech sites. I did manage to fix them prior to the update that just came out to fix it. I don't really know what I did exactly, but I got Gmail sorted out at least.
Okay, great. Unlike you, and atypical for me, I didn't upgrade at first, and it was primarily because of the Gmail issues, and I have a lot of filters and a lot of things set up in Gmail, which I'm really giving serious thought to moving to a different email provider because I'm not sure about the real longevity of Gmail down the road, but that could be something we could discuss at some point later on. But at present, I am a Gmail user. I forward my other accounts through Gmail and things like that. And I was seeing so many people struggling with mail, and I'm a big user of the Take Control book series from Tidbits Press. And Joe Kissel, who wrote one of the great books on upgrading to Mavericks, also wrote a book about using Apple Mail, and Gmail is one of the things that he discusses in that book. And he had his Gmail account heavily customized to work well with Lion and Mountain Lion and Apple Mail. And I had done the same thing. I'd followed his recommendations for hiding the All Mail label and doing various things on Gmail, because Gmail unfortunately doesn't behave very well as a standard IMAP mail system. They didn't follow a lot of the standards. They sort of did their own thing, I think, to make it work better on the Gmail website. But nonetheless, it seems like folks who rigorously followed, at least in my opinion, Joe Kissel's customizations for Mountain Lion and Lion had the most trouble when switching to Mavericks, because Mavericks changed the way it worked with Gmail. And even if you undid some of the customizations to make it work better with Mavericks, some people at least had a lot of trouble because, for one thing, there were probably thousands of emails in that All Mail label that had been hidden from IMAP that had to get re-indexed, and things would sort of get out of sync at that point, and it was anybody's guess whether your mail would ever get back in sync or not. Some people said it did, some people said it didn't, but that's all history now, because Apple came out last week sometime, maybe on Thursday, with a fix for the email, the Apple Mail client. It's a software update that you download. And so I went ahead and upgraded to Mavericks on Friday because of having the email fix, and I've had no problems. I've had one situation where I was trying to use an incorrect voiceover command, and voiceover actually did crash with me. And I can count the times on one hand that I've ever seen voiceover completely crash. But it did happen to me. It's only happened once, and I was using some incorrect commands and rather impatiently issuing those commands till I realized that they weren't, that the commands for selecting non-sequential items has changed in Mavericks. It's now vo command enter to make a selection. It used to be vo commands or vo space or something to add to a non-contiguous selection, but it's now option control enter or return to issue that command. And so VoiceOver did crash with me, and I actually had to restart my machine to get VoiceOver back because I had no speech whatsoever.
Man, because usually when VoiceOver crashes, it kind of brings itself back. You really broke it.
Yeah, I really did. You can normally toggle it back on with Command F5, but yeah. It would not come back at all without a restart. But I think that was as much. I mean, VoiceOver should never completely crash like that, even if you're doing a command wrong. But so I think some of these bulletproofing things will be done in later versions of Mavericks, but I'm finding it very, very usable. I'm not having any problems other than that crash really that I can speak of. Sounds like it's been a little less problem free for you.
I wouldn't say that I'm having problems that prohibit me from using Mavericks, not in the least, but I am noticing some strange things that are happening with my machine since upgrading, that the fixes, although they were primarily put out to address the mail issue, haven't seemed to have resolved in any way either. When I go, for example, from Yorofuguru, which is my Twitter client, to the desktop with VoShiftD, it says Finder Desktop. I assume then that I am in the Finder, and I do a command like Command Option L to bring up my downloads. And that is also a command which does something different in Yorofuguru. I can't remember what exactly right now. But it's as though the computer, although VoiceOver says I'm on the desktop, the Mac kind of hasn't caught up yet. And so it actually issues that command as though I'm still in Yorofuguru.
There's maybe a focus issue going on there.
Yes. And if I sit there, if I just do VoShiftD to bring up the desktop and wait about 10 to 15 seconds, then again I'll hear Finder Desktop, and then I'll know I'm truly on the desktop. So again, not a showstopper, but a little bit annoying when I want to get something done quickly.
Do you have the same problem if you command tab from Yorofuguru to the Finder window?
No, that is a difference I've noticed, is that when I command tab to Finder, it works just fine.
Because that's how I almost always do it, is just command tab from whatever application I'm in back to the Finder window, which also would likely put you on the desktop unless you had another Finder window open.
Right. And that's just what I've taken to doing to get around. And it's, like I said, definitely not a showstopper. Another thing that I have noticed is that when I first start up the machine, it's very rare that I have to restart this Mac. I'll sometimes have it running for a week or more at a time without having to do a reboot. But I've noticed that for the first minute or so that it's coming up, VoiceOver is very jumpy and stuttery. And that always happened a little bit with Mountain Lion, but it seemed just a little bit more pronounced since I upgraded to Mavericks. Now, I don't have a solid state hard drive in this machine. It's a late 2011 MacBook Pro, so that might have something to do with it. Again, not a showstopper. It's just I've noticed a little bit more of an increase of that since upgrading.
I haven't had that experience, but I do have My MacBook Pro just turned 1 year old on Halloween.
Aww.
And it is one of the solid state drive late 2012 models, and I've not experienced that issue, so it may be that your hard drive is loading some information and VoiceOver is kind of confused for a moment.
Trying to catch up, yeah.
Trying to catch up. I have seen that happen on other the other MacBook Pro that we have around here, which is actually a 2009 older one. I don't have Mavericks on it, but I have Mountain Lion on it, and I've seen that kind of thing happen when it's booting up. I've seen some improvements. For example, in mail, I now get information read about how many messages are in a particular mailbox that are unread.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't getting that with Mountain Lion.
Oh.
And I see some improvement with, I don't know whether you use a password on your machine or not, but
I do.
When you get to the when the machine boots, at least with mine, when it boots, there were times with Mountain Lion where when you got to the login screen, VoiceOver just wouldn't speak. It didn't happen all the time, but it would happen maybe, 10% of the time. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to type in your password with no feedback and then toggle VoiceOver on and off four times.
Oh, my goodness.
And then on the fourth time, VoiceOver would always start up.
Click your heels three times and say there's no place.
It was like doing a little voodoo. It really was, but it worked every time. And a lot of other people experienced this. But that all seems to be cleared up in Mavericks, at least from what I've seen so far. I've never seen VoiceOver fail at the login screen. And this is, I'm talking about when you wake up the computer, when the computer's been asleep and you lift the lid. This is when it would happen. So I've seen some improvements. And of course, there are a couple really great podcasts out there now on Mavericks. And the one that I have found to be the most complete and probably the easiest to follow everything on has been the recent one that David Woodbridge did. And that podcast is available on AppleViz, and it's also available at David's site. I'll put links in the show notes for it. But it's a very complete podcast on VoiceOver and Mavericks. I think he says it's not quite complete because he hasn't discovered everything yet. But he goes through the major features anyway and does a very nice job of demonstrating them and explaining them. And Sarah Alami also did some podcast on some of the new things in Mavericks, and she has that podcast available as a series of podcasts that you can actually purchase on her website. And Sarah's style is very different from David's. She sort of goes along and learns things as she's showing things about Mavericks. And I think for some people, that would be a really great style because there's that sense of discovery, that sense of adventure that's there in her podcast. And for people, that would be a lot of fun. For me, I think I prefer, for the most part, the style of that David uses, where he clearly has done a lot of rehearsing of his how he's going to demo something, and so the information is laid out very clearly and concisely. But both podcasts are really quite excellent ways to get up to speed on Mavericks at this point. I also read the Mavericks web review on Ars Technica by John Siracusa, who has reviewed all versions of OS X since the very beginning. So I think this is number 10 that he's done. He goes in tremendous detail. So for anyone who really wants to get geeky about what's under the hood with Mavericks, the John Siracusa review is really, really excellent. It's also available as an iBook, and that's how I read it. I got it from the iBook store. It's a very, very detailed, very complete, really, review. And I learned a lot about what Mavericks is doing as far as memory management and things like that. And so if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty, that's a good way to do it. And of course, there are other podcasts that Apple podcasters are doing, talking about Mavericks and talking about the new iPad Air. And I mean, there's a lot going on right now. It's an exciting time and plenty to learn.
Definitely.
All right. So anything else that you want to add at this point about Mavericks? I'm sure we'll be coming back to it many times as the year goes on and new updates come out and all that.
Nothing I can think of right now. Apple has done their usual good job with their release.
Yeah, I'm really pleased with it. And both of us just did the simplest upgrade. That is, we just installed it over top of Mountain Lion, leaving all of our data and everything intact. And mm-hmm. for most people, that type of installation, I think, is going to be just fine. It's really what Apple recommends people do. Of course,
yeah.
If you have problems, then you can go back and do a clean install. I obviously, again, always, always, always recommend everyone have a clone backup of your system before you upgrade from an earlier version of the operating system to Mavericks, because you, just in case something goes wrong.
You know, and I didn't do that, but now going forward, this will be week number 3. Every Sunday now, I clone my system onto this little hard drive I have here.
Excellent.
Yes.
I'm so glad to hear that. And most of the software that we use is Mavericks compatible. We're using a beta version of Audio Hijack Pro because Rogue Amoeba is still working on finishing the next version of Audio Hijack for Mavericks. But if you are hearing this podcast, you will know that the beta is working just fine.
If you're not, then you know it's broken.
Yeah. If you don't hear this podcast, you'll know for sure it's broken. That's exactly right. Well, it's been a pleasure spending this time with you, Allison. Thanks for...
You too, always. Always fun.
I think that's one of the things we enjoy about this podcast, is we enjoy spending time with each other, and that's a very cool thing.
Definitely.
All right, well, we will say so long for now. The information about Sue Martin's book and about some of the places where you can get more information on Mavericks will all be in the show notes, and I think I've said all I have to say at the moment, so... Until next time, it's so long from the Tech Doctor.
And this is Allison Hartley, the other Tech Doctor, not the tech nurse, but the doctor.
Absolutely.
Saying bye, everyone.